Welcome, everyone, to the podcast of the Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition, or NENSC. I'm Dan Poneman, co-chair of NENSC, along with my good friend and colleague, Admiral Rich Meese. And we are delighted to be joined here this morning by another good friend and a thought leader in our industry, Dr. Jeff Waxman. Jeff has an impressive academic background, having earned his PhD in physics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, also has master's degrees in physics and in nuclear engineering, educated at Columbia. I got to know Jeff when he was a program manager in the Strategic Capabilities Office in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he was really the brains behind and the inspiration for Project Pele, about which we will hear a lot shortly. Prior to his experience in that program, Jeff had incredibly useful experience for the things he's doing now at NASA, where he is part of the critical effort that led the United States to recover its long-challenged capabilities to launch commercial payloads into space. I'm not sure we'll have time to get into that, but he's an extraordinary individual and one of those people you run into from time to time in government who really is a visionary and who has already made an incredible difference. And he's going to make much more. So, Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Dan. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And it's a particular pleasure to talk on the record because you have to be so nice to me.
Speaking of which, I would be remiss if I did not note that you are speaking in your personal capacity. And so we appreciate your ability to do that with us, but we will respect that limitation. But look, just to get us started, nuclear is very much in the news these days. It hasn't always been when you and I were laboring in these vineyards many years ago, but can you perhaps get us started by speaking to the national security imperatives that led you personally and then led the Army to be interested in small nuclear reactors?
Sure. Well, I think people always sometimes forget about infrastructure and logistics. It's not necessarily the sexiest part of anybody's budget. You know, I'm currently working for the Army, and in the Army, we like, you know, the sexy stuff is tanks and artillery pieces and missile defense systems. And we sometimes forget that energy underlies everything. There's a famous saying that's been attributed to everyone from Napoleon to Rommel, which is that amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. And in the end, wars are won with logistics. Without energy, as well as things like food and medicine and ammunition, war can't go on. Your planes don't take off, et cetera. So I think there's been a growing understanding of the need for more energy. And I think particularly as we have seen in the modern world, both additional challenges to international trade, but increasing risk of near-peer conflict. And I think we've also seen that cyber vulnerabilities mean that we are no longer even safe in the homeland. So in prior wars, we would struggle maybe to move our logistics to the front, but we always knew that on our shores, we could move anything anywhere we wanted, we had power if we wanted. And that's just no longer the case. We've seen recently with things like the Colonial Pipeline incident, and others, that if a conflict were to happen, we cannot trust that we have energy here. And so that has required us to start thinking about how can we have reliable energy here? And currently, our only real option is storing a whole bunch of fossil fuels on our installations. And it would be nice to have an alternative. And the only real alternative that exists is nuclear power.
That's a brilliant way of thinking about it. I hadn't really heard it described that way, but you're absolutely right. When we see, you know, you could have cyber attacks on the grid, you could have a number of things like the Colonial Pipeline, for example, and we cannot any longer take that for granted. But for folks who don't know already, Jeff, please explain what Project Pele is and how it fits into that logistical scenario you just described.
Sure. So the idea that nuclear power could potentially be a solution to the logistical challenges of the DoD actually goes back to this makes me feel old now, but the middle of the 2010s, and that led to some congressional language in the fall of 2018 that asked the DoD to put together a plan of how they might deploy a nuclear reactor at a DoD site. At that time, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering saw that language and knew what happens when Congress asks for reports, which is often you just ask some staffer to put together some kind of C-plus report, you take 3 years, and then you send the essay over. And no one reads it. And he said, this is actually important enough that we should try to do something about it. So he tried to stand up a program to try to build an actual nuclear reactor that we can deploy on a military installation. That program was to be called Project Pele, and it was assigned to the Strategic Capabilities Office, and I was hired to start it. So when I was hired, I was handed the name Pele, and I was handed a two-page white paper, but we had no money and no plan, and it was my job to put that together. So that started in the fall of 2018, and I ran that program for the next 6.5 years. And over that time, we actually stood up a real program. We got a bunch of money, and we designed a reactor, and that reactor is now being built as we speak. So we actually had a groundbreaking in Idaho last fall. And this year, I have a new job now, so I don't have the updates down to the minute, but I know that they have started to build the reactor. They have also manufactured the fuel. There's been a lot of progress in that reactor. For those who know about reactor generations, United States has a bunch of Generation 2 reactors. Generation 1 is the stuff right after World War II. Generation 3 reactors have been deployed around the world in places like Korea and Russia and China. We don't have any here in the United States, but we're trying to skip ahead to Generation 4. And the first Generation 4 reactor in the world was built in China. It's called the HDRPM. It turned on about a year or two ago. And the first Generation 4 reactor that's going to turn on in the Western world will be Pele. It is hoping to turn on in the latter part of 2027. So it's fairly soon. I know there are some other reactors out there claiming they're going to turn earlier than that, but that's a little bit of hype stuff. Realistically, 2027 is as early as anyone's going to turn a reactor on.
Okay. So for those who are into this kind of detail, and that's a great laydown so far, if you don't mind, say a bit more, this fourth generation design, Project Pele, what is the fuel? What is the coolant? What is the output? Those sorts of specs would be helpful to our listeners.
Well, Dan, I'm gonna partially answer that one because I'm under some restrictions about what I can talk about. And the broad definition of Generation 4, I mean, there's different definitions of it, but I can tell you that Pele is a high temperature gas reactor. And in terms of the fuel, it is a TRISO-based reactor, which most Generation 4 reactors are. Not all of them, but most of them are TRISO-based. The advantage of TRISO being that it can withstand temperatures well over 1800 degrees Celsius, which means you just have a huge safety margin and it allows you to have an inherently safe system. What we mean by an inherently safe reactor is that you no longer need the layers of safety redundancy. So traditional nuclear reactors, you say, well, if this breaks, here's the backup. And if the backup breaks, here's the backup to the backup. And maybe there's a backup to the backup to the backup. But at some point, someone needs to take some action to prevent something bad from happening. And that's why you can have a scenario like Fukushima where you lose power and everything all at the same time and you can have a problem. The concept of an inherently safe reactor is that even if you lose all your safety systems, you lose total control of the reactor, it will still naturally shut itself down and it will not melt. And so that's why a lot of people are doing their Gen 4 reactors based on TRISO. You can use TRISO fuel in a number of different things. You can use it in molten salt. You can use it in a heat pipe reactor. But for us, it is a gas reactor.
Got it. Okay. And now to relate that specific program to the initial comment you made, in what ways could reactors like the Pele reactor help mitigate those vulnerabilities that you were talking about initially of vulnerability to cyber attack or to physical attack or even, you know, extreme weather, et cetera?
Yeah, so typically critical Army installations try to have 2 weeks of backup power. And typically the form that that takes is a large amount of diesel sitting in large tanks. And it's always some form of fossil fuel because there's no other way to do it. And so if you go to relatively strategic locations, like let's say if you go to the island of Guam, what you will see are just huge tanks of fossil fuels all over the island. You will be sitting in your four-star hotel on the balcony looking out on the ocean. And if you tilt your head to the left, you will see just huge tanks of fuel. It is the world's easiest and most obvious military target. And so as we look, well, what else can we do? The reality is, I'm not like an anti-solar zealot, but the reality is no one is going to power installations with solar and batteries anytime soon. It is not feasible. It's not possible. You just can't shove enough solar panels and batteries on an installation to make that possible. Solar and batteries can be part of the solution, but it cannot be the entire solution. And our real fear is a long-term hard blackout. We tend to use the term blackout colloquially in America because we've never experienced a real one. We have rolling blackouts in America. We have never in the last 50 years experienced a real blackout. The closest we came was in Texas when that snowstorm happened a few years ago. They were within 3 minutes of a blackout. And what happens when you have a real blackout is that all your spinning inertia rolls down and your grid actually shuts. If that happens, DARPA has looked at this. What happens if the grid actually goes down? You'd be looking at no electricity for months. So Texas was 3 minutes away from being without power for months. I don't think we fully grasped how close to an absolute disaster we were in Texas a few years ago. And that was purely natural. That was without an adversary trying to use cyber attacks to take the grid down. So as I sit here in my current job, where I'm acting as the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment, energy and energy resilience is a key part of this job. We have to consider the possibility that we might be in a world where we have parts of the grid that are down for months. And how do we manage to continue to project power to be able to continue to keep on the fight? And so if we can have nuclear power or some combination of things that can keep stuff on indefinitely, that would be a tremendous game changer for the DoD and the Army.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned Guam, and then you talked a lot about what could happen in CONUS, as we say, right here in the United States. But can you talk a little bit about the deployment of these kinds of reactors and where? Obviously, from what you've said, you know, U.S. territory, et cetera, et cetera. Do you foresee, you know, either now or in the foreseeable future, having these in sort of forward deployed mode? If we are, I'm recalling the horrible statistics about what percentage of the casualties in Iraq were lost in providing the supply chain and bringing the diesel to theater. You know, one can imagine, Jeff, you know, a much more robust situation in which you have reliable power really, you know, all over the world. Is that contemplated or possible?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is where I'll remind people that this is just Jeff's opinion and not speaking for the entire DoD. However, I think it's important to emphasize that the phrase forward deployed has a much broader meaning than it used to. Because one might ask, you know, is Guam a forward location? It might be as far forward as we might be in a future conflict, but it might be, you know, it's like 1,000 miles away from where the shooting might be happening. So forward deployed doesn't mean you're in a trench, you're 100 feet from the enemy. It can have a pretty broad definition. That said, I think that for deployment of nuclear, you want to start with the lowest hanging fruit. So in the same way that when the Navy got nuclear going in the 50s, they started with submarines because that's the lowest hanging fruit. And then they worked their way up to carriers, and then they worked their way up to cruisers. They didn't start with nuclear powered planes, right? That's the hardest thing. So similarly, we're not going to start with the hardest thing. And the hardest thing is always going to be the increased mobility. So the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit is going to be power that is at installations in CONUS. That's the easiest. And so that most likely would be where the early deployment would be. There absolutely is a lot of value for this sort of technology in remote locations. So that could be on Pacific Islands, that could be in the Arctic. And so that is absolutely something that we're at least thinking about, if that could be feasible, starting to think through what sort of different legal and political challenges there might be with that. But the early deployment will almost certainly be CONUS installations.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Definitely start with the low-hanging fruit. And I know that there are never any issues among services in the Pentagon, right? But I have read about, Jeff, this agile engagement strategy in the Air Force, the agile combat employment strategy. And it was intriguing to me because one worries about a place like, obviously, Taiwan, which is, I think, 95% dependent on imported energy sources. They've got TSMC, an incredibly strategic asset, which has incredible power requirements. And there they are, you know, at a moment's notice, they could be cut off. So I guess I'll just ask you broadly, is there possible cross-fertilization between the efforts you're doing in the Army, what the Air Force is doing? Is there some strategic coherence between that strategy that they've been working on and what you are doing over in the Army?
Yeah, no, Taiwan had the brilliant idea to realize that they're next door to a hostile neighbor with a far superior Navy and decide to make themselves entirely dependent on shipboard imports of gas. It's really brilliant. To use an internet meme, they looked at Germany's energy policy and said, hold my beer. Now, in terms of within the other services, I mean, you know, the recent executive order that President Trump signed names the Army the executive agent for installation operation of nuclear power. And so we're still trying to figure out exactly what that means. I think sometimes there's a misperception that executive orders get passed and then the next day everything's up and running. The reality is the executive order gets passed and then you got to spend some time having the lawyers read it. You got to figure out what your governance is going to be, how you're going to structure everything, you know, how exactly does the executive agency work? You need to make sure that all the different relevant parties with equities weigh in. So we're still working on that internally, and it's probably going to be another couple of months before we get that all settled down, exactly how it's going to engage. But yeah, what you described, agile combat employment, it came out of the fact that when hypersonic missiles started to come to the fore about a decade ago, we started to realize that we really had nothing that could stop hypersonic missiles. There are very few of them. They're very expensive, but once they start, you can't stop them. So we basically realized that if we were getting hypersonic missiles shot at us, certain locations will be indefensible. And therefore, we can't have all of our stuff on one island in one location because it will all get taken out. So the idea was, if war starts, everyone spread out, get all over the place, and we can't shoot everything down, but they also don't have enough missiles to shoot everything we have. That was the general idea. Now, there's certainly been a lot of work over the last decade to try to provide defense against hypersonics. So we have some defenses here. And so, you know, tactics and strategies are changing over time. But if we do imagine a world where we have to spread out over a bunch of island specific, that is a tremendous, tremendous energy challenge. And I personally love the idea of power ships, which were something that the DoD made heavy use of in World War II and in the Korean War. In fact, we even had a power ship that was nuclear powered, that powered the Panama Canal for several years. We got away from those because we had total dominance of logistics. And now as we reach our new world where that's no longer the case, I think power ships are potentially a solution to that problem.
That is fascinating. Well, I want to get to the nexus between the civil and the military, but I can't get out of here without having noted you said that you inherited the name Project Pele. You know, inquiring readers want to know, is it really named after the soccer star or what?
It is named after the goddess of fire and power. I actually went to the big island of Hawaii to visit Pele's crater. In my old office, I had a Pele poster on the wall. I would say in general, I love deity names for programs. So I was the one who came up with the Artemis name originally for NASA's moon landing.
Oh, really?
And as we look at the new Army program we want to stand up here, I've been kicking around different mythological names. I have one in mind. I don't want to say it yet because we have to run it through all the traps. But I'm always a fan of mythological names for programs.
All right. We may have to take that part of the conversation offline if I have some ideas to send you. Okay. So one of the great things about our nuclear history and very much part of the DNA of this Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition is the ecosystem, right, between the military and the civilian. And so much has been written about this, but, you know, obviously the nuclear Navy and the great leadership at the vision level of President Eisenhower and the implementation level, which is so important, as you've noted, of Admiral Hyman Rickover, you know, we got those reactors up and running. All of these so-called fourth generation reactors, you and I both know, were actually being looked at in the 1950s, but it was Admiral Rickover says, that's nice. You keep working on all those other fancy designs, but we need a small one that fits on a boat. And it was your point, right? The low-hanging fruit. Let's take the light water reactor. We can stick it on a submarine. And then when they canceled an aircraft carrier, they had a couple of extra reactors lying around. They go to Duquesne Light Company and say, how'd you like to try these? And that was the beginning of the whole civilian nuclear fleet. So You'll tell me 90-ish reactors floating around the oceans and another 94 running, 20% of our power in the U.S. So that's great. And I guess the question I have now is, with what you're doing here, what do you see as the kind of ecosystem impact of Project Pele and more generally, the ability of what you are doing in the Army to sort of seed a broader effort, initially nationally, but potentially globally, of a new generation of deployed fourth generation reactors?
Yeah, I mean, the way you described what Rickover did is completely accurate. And as you said, there were designs that were more efficient and better in basically every way than pressurized water reactors. But when you're putting a boat under the water, pressurized water reactors are what makes sense. In fact, I think Rickover had a quote that said that if the whole ocean was made of molten salt, some damn fool would try to build a water reactor. And it's the same basic concept. So the thing is, from the industry perspective, I mean, there's been lots of studies about this, I'm sure you're aware of, that the pressurized water reactors we built our commercial grid out of are not really the logical reactor design you would choose for commercial reactors. They have complications. They are more expensive for a number of reasons. However, because the Navy had fleshed out the pressurized water technology, that was what we were good at. That was what we had a supply chain for. That's what we had expertise for. That's what we got good at. And so while these other reactors on paper are more efficient and cheaper, et cetera, we have not successfully actually made them cheaper and better because we haven't been able to build enough of them that we get good enough at it. And so as we try to finally move to this world of advanced reactors, this is why we have to be strategic about it. Having 15 different companies trying 15 different concepts is not going to work because you will never build up enough learning. You'll never build up enough of a supply chain to make it happen. So part of the idea behind Project Pele was to try to kind of shrink the number of possible technologies and build out a supply chain and a group of experts that we can then move forward with that sort of concept. It doesn't mean that we're locking in on one company or one specific design, but just have a supply chain and just people who get hands-on and build enough reactors that they get good at them. In the same way that SpaceX has gotten so good at building rockets because they build so many rockets. Whereas when NASA's trying to build SLS that launches once every 2 years, how good can anyone be at anything that they do once every 2 years? So this is part of what I believe is a big part of the executive agency in the Pentagon. This is part of what I'm trying to flesh out internally here, is that it's not that we're going to tell the Air Force and Navy what to do. You know, they can choose different vendors and that's fine, but we need to kind of limit the option space to make sure that they're not spinning off in completely new directions with expertise that's not relevant to other expertise, because otherwise we will just never get good enough that it will become cheaper than what we already have. And this is something that DoD can do really well, and we have done before in things like nuclear power. The DoD has the capability to run programs, and they have the need that they're willing to pay a little bit extra to make technologies happen. And then commercial sector can then flourish out of that and take, okay, the DoD has shown the path, and now we're going to work on trying to make it cheaper, because that's what the commercial sector is good at.
Well, that's brilliant. And, I'm recalling, Jeff, my time at the Department of Energy, and, we had a very robust dialogue going on with some of your predecessors, because not only when it comes to energy, but when it comes to things like buildings, as you know, DoD is the biggest landlord in the world. You have, I can't even remember how many millions of square feet under roof. And so building efficiency, it's a huge driver of innovation to have the scale and the ability of the DoD, as you said, to sort of pay a premium for those early first movers to end up driving the cost down. So I guess this, I'm just thinking out loud here, but this makes me wonder in terms of this incubation system of, and I agree with you completely, we can't let 100 flowers bloom here. We just will not get good enough at any one of them to reap the benefits of scale, right? What would you say about sort of the dialogue happening between Army and DoD more broadly and the Department of Energy? Because obviously they had this advanced reactor development program. One of the reactors they selected obviously was a high temperature gas reactor and so forth. Is there some symbiosis, a word I'm not crazy about, between the two departments? How should we think about this?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is good dialogue happening across the agencies, and it's happening at a high level, which is critical. Dan, you were a deputy energy secretary, you know how this stuff works, and you know how agencies work and get things done. And you know that for decisions, for important decisions to actually get made at agencies, they have to be made by realistically, like deputy secretaries or higher, right? It has to be at the deputy's level. And you need stuff to get to that point to make decisions. And the problem in the past for things like nuclear power has been people will say, hey, we want to do nuclear power, but then they dump it to like sub-IPCs and like GS-13s just talking amongst themselves. And that will never filter up to a decision that a deputy is going to make. And so one of the things that I thought I really appreciated after these executive orders were passed is that the message came down from the White House that this is not just a press release. Like, we actually have to deliver now. And so when we held the first post-executive order meeting, the message from the White House was assistant secretaries are higher. We're not doing this at a low level. Like, we need to we have important things to figure out on, like, how are we handling nuclear waste? How are we going to make nuclear reprocessing happen? How do we stand up all the different governance, regulatory changes we have to do? And things have been moving really fast. I mean, Department of Energy has already done most of the work necessary to update its regulations to be able to approve reactors faster. And they've been able to do that, by the way, basically with the Pele team, the folks at Department of Energy and Idaho National Lab, who were at the center of Project Pele, took all that learning and said, what is the stuff that worked? What's the stuff that could be improved? And that's the new regulatory process. So we've been able to basically leverage Pele, leverage the fact that the White House is saying, hey, we're serious about this. You got to get on this. And that is making stuff happen fast. And the agencies are all talking to each other. There's still a lot of work to be done. We haven't solved anything. We haven't built a reactor yet. But I'm definitely very encouraged with how things have been going over the past, I don't know, 5-6 weeks since the executive order was passed.
That is encouraging, Jeff. And a few minutes ago, you were talking about supply chain, which is so critical and so vulnerable. And perhaps you could say a few words about making sure that as we're developing these reactors, that we do, in fact, have the supply chain necessary to support it. And one of the syllogisms we used to say when I was in government was no fuel, no fun. And we obviously have a strategic challenge in the sense that when it comes to enriched uranium, which most of these reactors, I think all that you're probably looking at, require, you know, while we weren't looking, so to speak, Russia ended up with 44% of the world's capacity. You know, China's got another 10 or 15%, and the United States is effectively out. The company I led, as you know, started making this very special kind of high assay low enriched uranium, but at a very small scale. So what can you tell us about the supply chain? And I should say, in fairness, the U.S. Congress, at the same time that they're eliminating the imports from Russia as of 2028, has authorized a program to enrich uranium and provided, depending on how you count, $2.7 to $3.4 billion. So it's not like they're not looking at the problem. But what can you tell us about the supply chain, and what are we doing to address some of these challenges, like the situation with enriched uranium?
Yeah, so there's two sides to supply chain. So one is what you're describing, which is we need to be able to stand up capabilities that have enough money and enough business that's worth making things efficient. The problem for nuclear projects in the past has been that everything people buy is a one-off, and you tell the company, well, we want to buy one now, and maybe 10 years from now, we'll buy another. So the company says, well, that's great, but we're not going to stand up an assembly line for that. We're going to have someone custom hand make this, and it's going to take a year, and it's going to be really expensive. And so we need enough demand that it's worth the companies making the investments to do all this stuff efficiently. And so that's why, like, as you're describing, the uranium program is intended to have enough money that it incentivizes companies like your former company, Centrus, to scale out and be willing to make those capital investments so that they can drive the per unit cost down. The other piece of this that's relevant for nuclear is that you have to actually determine how these materials are going to behave. And this gets at the point about 100 flowers blooming is we struggle. And I think a lot of these small companies, startup companies, don't realize this problem yet, which is that the engineering codes that we use, the nuclear codes that we use, are designed around light water reactors. That is what we're used to doing in this country. And those have a very specific set of conditions, temperatures and fluxes that we're used to operating in. when we push to these advanced reactors, part of the way you get increased efficiency is by operating at higher temperatures and higher fluxes and having higher differentials, higher gradients. And the problem is that the codes have not been validated in those conditions. And that was one of the things that was stark to us in Pele. And we saw that Project Marvel had the same challenge. And we've seen that the big commercial companies, X-Energy and TerraPower doing ARDP, have found the same problem, which is that the codes are wrong. And the only way to validate the codes is to actually do some laboratory tabletop testing, and then you update the codes. And so this is why part of my message inside the Pentagon has been, well, okay, other services, you guys want to choose your own prime contractor, that's fine. But let's use the same alloy of stainless steel in the reactor, because once we validated one, it's a waste of time and money for you guys to validate a completely different alloy just to try to get a 2% performance boost. And so this is why we have to be strategic about the designs and concepts we choose, so that we have a narrow enough supply chain that we have enough demand for all these parts and materials that we can do what I said a moment ago, which is have enough demand that it's the companies selling that stuff are incentivized to do it efficiently and build out an assembly line. I know it's a very complicated, nine-part answer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, but it raises kind of a lot of questions too, because you talk about the need for testing of new materials and so forth. Brings up a whole question of regulation, right? And so maybe, I'm sure folks are curious, how do we think about, since the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulates civilian reactors, right? And the Department of Energy, there's the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, which oversees the safety of the DOE nuclear facilities, part of the weapons complex. How are DOD reactors going to be regulated, Jeff? What is the wellspring of expertise that you will draw from to do that? And then when we think about translating what you are doing in DOD to the commercial sector, then how does that work with this new, with some internal regulatory entity that governs project on a base, mm-hmm. send that over to the NRC? How does all that work?
Yes, I mean, there's going to be formal connections between the DoD and the DOE and the NRC in some way. But in general, the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy and the NRC have equal and parallel authorities to regulate reactors. So there's a misperception that the DoD needed an authority to regulate reactors, and it's not the case. The Army regulated its own reactors back in the 50s and 60s. The Air Force regulated their own reactors. We have all the authorities. What we lack, to use your phrase, is the wellspring of knowledge. The Army, the Army still has a reactor office. It exists, but as of today, it's one person. It's a lieutenant colonel, that in and of itself, the most brilliant lieutenant colonel in the world is not going to single-handedly regulate a reactor. So what we want to do is to try to leverage the experience and the expertise at the DOE National Labs, particularly the people who've already done this on Pele and Marvel, and to try to leverage as much of that as we can. So the executive order requires the Army to regulate. So the Army will have to come in over the top and be the final regulator. But we want to lean heavily on the Department of Energy to provide that expertise out of its laboratories. And then the really tricky part, which is kind of implied in your question, which is how do these different regulatory bodies work together? Because what we can have is that the Department of Energy says this is safe. And then, okay, a design's approved. And then they go to the NRC and the NRC goes, no, we disagree with that. And this has been brought up before. This is not the first time there's been an effort to try to align the DOE and NRC on the regulations, but there's a really serious effort now to figure out how we do that. It's not going to be as simple as, hey, the DOD has approved a reactor, therefore the NRC has to automatically approve it. It's not going to be quite like that, but we need to do a much better job of having consistency across these regulatory agencies, because otherwise it's impossible if you have to design a completely different reactor, whether you're DOE or DOD or NRC regulated. And so that's one of the really complex things that we're trying to figure out now and over the next few months.
So let's drill down a little bit on this crosswalk between civilian and military. For example, if you deploy a dozen or however many of these reactors, Pele's and its progeny, on military bases, are they going to be microgrids, or are they going to be feeding into the grid, or a fallback in case of Texas happens somewhere else? How do we think about that?
So realistically, you want to be tied into the grid. Having a microgrid that is disconnected from the grid is going to be a real challenge for reliability purposes. And so this gets at the regulatory question of, can a DoD or DOE licensed reactor sell to the grid? You will find lawyers who will tell you no. If an electron touches the grid, it must be NRC licensed. However, if you press those people and say, please tell me where in statute it says that, they will admit that it is not in statute anywhere. And in fact, there's already precedent that a DOE licensed reactor called EBR-2 sold electricity to the grid in Idaho in the 1980s, 1990s. So there's no law whatsoever that says that a reactor that sells to the commercial grid must be NRC licensed. What the law says is that if the reactor is commercial purposes, then it's NRC licensed. If it's for DOE purposes, it's DOE licensed. And if it's for DOD purposes, it's DOD licensed. So then the question becomes legally, how much do you have to sell to the DOD base for it to be DOD purposes? And, you know, this is where what I'm trying to seek now, and I've had these conversations with Congress already, and we're having these conversations with Congress, is we need to provide some clarity. It is not that we need a new authority. We are not changing the Atomic Energy Act. We need to provide clarity on the Atomic Energy Act. And so there's some legislative ideas bubbling around, and I'm, you know, we'll see where that ends up, but I'm very eager to have something in the FY27 NDA that makes it clear that as long as we are predominantly selling to the DoD base, we can sell some to the commercial grid as well. And that will just provide resilience and reliability for everybody, because you want to be tied into a larger grid if you can. And what we're trying to be, you know, fair on is we're not trying to create a backdoor around the NRC here. We're not trying to say, hey, you could set up an AP1000 on a base and skirt NRC rules. That's not what we're saying. But we're simply saying that if our reactor is on a DoD base and it's for DoD purposes and the DoD is primarily paying for it, then it's okay if some of it goes on the commercial grid. And so that's just something we're going to have to work with Congress over the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay. And another one of the benefits of having the government behind this, and with the national security imperative that I think you clearly laid out for fourth generation nuclear in terms of resilience against cyber and physical attack, let's talk about scale for a second, because certain people I know, like me, have been for many years saying, look, you're not even going to really test. This is the point you made a few minutes ago. You're not even going to test the business model properly for small reactors unless you build a bunch of them, right? I'm not the only one. Jeff Lyash of TVA said that for years. I don't want to build one. I want to build 20 and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And so when one thinks of, right, the possible applications across, you know, the vast width of DoD and its responsibilities, you know, even the low-hanging fruit alone, right, is a lot. And I'm also thinking back when I was working with my friends at the Army Corps of Engineers on Superstorm Sandy, it would have been really nice not to have only diesel looking around to supplant all the power that was lost in Superstorm Sandy and so forth. So what can you say, Jeff? I noticed in the executive orders, you got authority for like one, you know, reactor. What can you tell us about scale and the potential? Obviously, I'm not asking to predict budgets and so forth, but how should we think about the role of government? And I will extend this beyond DOD, because, you know, who also needs reliable power are those supercomputers and DOE facilities, right? Supercomputer, you don't like to turn those on and off, right? You want 724 reliable power. So I used to think let's build, you know, a bunch of them, half on DoD bases and half on DOE, you know, national lab sites. But what role do you see DoD, Army, and then the U.S. government more broadly in getting us to the scale to get us over what sometimes we call the second valley of death? Once you've demonstrated the technical viability of a technology, the second valley of death is how you can make it viable at commercial scale.
Yeah, no, that's a key point you're getting at. And I think back to the early days of nuclear power in the United States, that people looked at, you know, from a physics perspective, right, the bigger your reactor is, the more efficient it is. So they kept making reactors bigger, 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 bigger. Every reactor was bigger than the last one. But the problem was they never got good at any of them. They never built a whole bunch of the same thing. And so while that physics is true, you're just never going to build enough gigawatt nuclear plants that you're going to get that efficient at making them. And so the idea, as you said, is if you make the reactors a little bit smaller, you could build enough of them that while in theory they're less efficient, you'll have more of an assembly line, you'll be able to make them cheaper. Now you get some sort of like Laffer curve where at some point the reactors get small enough that even making an infinity of them will still be too expensive, right? Like I don't think a half megawatt reactor will ever be as cheap as a gigawatt reactor. But you need to, as you say, you need to build enough that you start to get that learning, you reach that fabled nth of a kind. And the challenge there is simply budget. And the reason why we haven't committed to any specific number of reactors is because we haven't decided what our budget is going to be. And that's an honest answer. The Army is still thinking about it, right? The FY26 budget is out the door. So we're looking at FY27. Are we going to budget for this and at what level? And so until we make that decision, I don't want to commit to anything. One thing I have seen in my time in government is that government agencies love press releases on nuclear. They love to announce we're going to do things, but then nothing happens. And I'm very public with my commitment that I'm not going to do a press release program. If I announce that we're doing something, then it means we're really doing it. And so I'm going to make sure that we have the money in place before I make an announcement like that. And the model I see for this is the model that NASA used to get SpaceX going, which was when they were getting rockets going, they recognized that SpaceX's first couple rockets were going to be unreliable. They're going to be problematic. They're going to be expensive, but they worked by providing technical support and also money. They got SpaceX to the point that they eventually built the Falcon 9, and it got good enough that then SpaceX could drive the price down. And now NASA can get rides with SpaceX rockets way cheaper than they could if they were building their own rockets because they've reached nth of a kind. And so we have to do something similar here. We have to provide technical support to these companies. We have to provide them some upfront money to help them close that business case and help them find a way to get to that nth of a kind. And so we're really trying to leverage the learning of how NASA did that the first time. I know most of the people who are behind that program and trying to bring that expertise to bear here as well.
I think it's a great concept. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. But before we get too far from the regulatory discussion, which was very interesting, if you can, you know, quickly tell us, what would you see as the greatest regulatory barriers, unique to this next generation of reactors that needs to be overcome to get to real deployment at scale?
I mean, I don't think there are any huge regulatory barriers. Like, I think the biggest challenges we have are ourselves and just getting good at designing and building reactors. I don't think there are a lot of rules that really held us back. If there's one thing that holds us back, it is a regulatory process. That has always been my criticism of the NRC, is not that their rules are necessarily bad, it's that the process is bad. And by what I mean by that is that the NRC traditionally, and they're getting better at it, but traditionally, they don't like to engage directly with companies. Everything is formal. They say, submit your design, and we will tell you what we liked or didn't like. We will send you paperwork back, and then we will send back and forth. And the problem with that is that's just not a good way to design something and make it safe. And the process we were able to set up under Project Pele with the Department of Energy was much better. As we were formulating the concept of formulating the design, we would bring the regulators in and say, hey, this is what we think we're going to do. And then the regulators can say, well, hey, if you do that, we're not going to like that. Don't do that. Or if you're going to do that, you need to run this test, because if this test doesn't work, then you're going to need to fix that. So it's better to figure this out now before you get too far down the road with your design. And need to inject the regulators in as early as possible and have open conversations, let the engineers talk to the regulators. And that is the biggest thing. It's not that the rules per se, it's the process.
That is brilliant. I am, as we say, I'm in violent agreement with you on that. That makes a ton of sense. Okay, you have planted some seeds for the final few minutes of our conversation. You noted early on that the only Gen 4 reactor that's been deployed is from China. I will add to the mix the fact that China built 37 reactors in the last 10 years, and we built two. I will add to the fact that the Russian order book for nuclear powers reactors being sold internationally is $200 billion. And while we're working hard on getting a few orders, we're at zero, right, so far in terms of, done and dusted deals in the can. So I guess the question I have for you is, what you're doing, does this provide us a foothold, on the back of this set of four executive orders, which is obviously very bullish on nuclear generally, including on restoring U.S. exports? How should we think about what you're doing, Jeff, in the larger context of the geostrategic competition we have with China and Russia globally when it comes to nuclear?
So it's been a couple months since I went to the IAEA website that tracks the number of reactors under construction, land-based reactors under construction. But last time I checked, the United States was at zero and China was at 29. And, you know, we often point out that China's leading design is an AP1000. They stole the design from Westinghouse and they build them, and they can build them way cheaper and way faster than we do. And everyone's aware of that. Hey, we built the two Vogtle reactors in Georgia. They went wildly over cost and schedule. And look, they're building them in China so much cheaper. But the part of that story that people don't remember is that when China built their first AP1000s, those went wildly over cost and schedule too. And China learned and built more and more and more. And now they've gotten really good at it. Whereas what we did in America is we struggled through those two Vogtle reactors. And in fact, the second Vogtle reactor was 30% cheaper than the first one. And then we stopped. And all those engineers and tradesmen who figured out how to do it went off and did other things. That was just a huge mistake that we made. And that's why one of the things in the executive order is to try to build a bunch more of these big reactors, try to build 10, to actually try to get that learning to happen. So this is really the challenge. Can we actually build enough of these suckers that we can actually figure out how to do things the way that the Chinese do? And I see this as part of a larger issue with manufacturing. It's not only nuclear reactors that we struggle to build. We struggle to build bridges and trains and anything that's big in the United States. I don't know if you paid attention to the high-speed rail in California. It's not going that great either. It doesn't mean that fundamentally we can't build trains. It just means that we just don't build enough of this stuff that we get good at it. And so this is one of the big pushes in this administration. How do we learn how to make things in America again? How do we build big things? Now, I'm not saying that we're going to single-handedly solve that here, but there are a lot of different pieces of this across government. This is not an easy thing. I don't have an easy solution to this. My unofficial motto for Project Pele always was, if this were easy, it would have been done already. And so we recognize that this is a really hard challenge, but this is what I enjoy doing. I don't want to do easy things. And so this is what me and a number of other people are devoted on trying to solve right now, is how do we figure out how to build stuff cheaper and faster?
I don't know if you meant to, but you sort of paraphrased JFK, his famous speech, I think at Rice, when he said, we choose to go to the moon, not because it is easy, but because it is hard, because it is the best test of what we are capable of, or words to that effect. But I would love to think, and I think about Project Pele as potentially that kind of vanguard. You know, you have a lot of background in the space program. Think of all the incredible industries and prosperity driven out of the Apollo program, you know, over the years, many things. So I guess as an exit question, I'll ask you to, you know, wax rhapsodic on that, the meaning of your efforts, both, you know, originally at the Strategic Capabilities Office, now in Army, in driving Pele and other advanced reactors. What can this mean in terms of the United States really recovering the leadership that in the 50s we enjoyed unchallenged when it comes to things nuclear, both domestically and internationally? I'll give you the final word. Sure.
So I'll bring it back to my point about amateur state tactics, professional state logistics. If you look at World War I and World War II, look at the technology that the different sides had. Who had the highest performing plane? Who had the highest performing tank? Who had the highest performing boats? It was never the United States. You know, most of it was Germany had the best stuff. But the challenge is logistics. So if you look at, for instance, take the Eastern Front of World War II and the Tiger tanks versus the T-34s. The Tiger tanks were unambiguously better technology, but they would break down. They were difficult to fix, where the T-34s just kept working. And that Russia could make five of those for every one of the Tigers. And so they lost 2-1 in every battle. In the end, they were going to win the war. And same for us. We did not have better tanks, but we could just make more of them and just overwhelmed with numbers. We have now reversed that in the modern world. So for all of China's technological capabilities, the most exquisite stuff still gets made in the United States. We have the best technology. We have the best equipment, but we cannot build stuff to scale. And if we were to get into a conflict with China, we would have the best planes and we would have the best boats, but China would have more of everything. And we have now reversed everything from World War II. So this is the challenge. It is not, how do we make technology again? Because we still have the best universities. We have the best engineers. We have the best technology. We need to figure out how to make things at scale and be able to, at large scale, produce again in this country. And we finally realized in the last few years that it is a vulnerability if we're coming up with all the technology in America, but then we're actually making it in other places. We have to actually learn how to make it here. And that is the big challenge. And it's a big focus of this administration. And I think it's an increasingly bipartisan interest in building more here. And so that's, I think more than anything, is the political challenge of the next few years.
Well, that was fantastic. I think the first thing we need to do is clone you, you know, get you little mini Jeff Waxman's salted all over the bureaucracy. We need more change agents like you. And I think our listeners will see why. So I want to really thank you. I know how busy you are. You're running so many important activities for the Army and for the government. I want to remind our listeners that you have been listening to this podcast that's hosted by the Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition. That's NENSC.org, NENSC.org. We encourage you to sign up for updates. We will be back from time to time with fascinating guests like Dr. Jeff Waxman. And I think all of us, Jeff, owe a debt of gratitude to you for what you've been doing all these years and what you're still going to do for the country in the years ahead. So thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to everyone for listening.